You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this should be going out the week of the 6th, November 2023. I've been, as always, I really need your financial assistance. I know so many of you have been very good. If you haven't helped out yet, I'm asking you to do it in one of the many ways that you can access on the site here. But not just for myself, also because Sven Longshanks is still in prison. In fact, he's been moved. I finally found out where. HMP Berwyn, which is in Wrexham, Bridge Road. His number is A5903EY. So I think I said this last week, but don't send anything to the old address. Be careful when you write him, be careful what you say, because everything that you send is being read. It doesn't shock me to have some people wondering if enemies are, in fact, writing him as friends, saying, you know, stupid and crazy things. Anyway, speaking of stupid and crazy things, last week I began to discuss one of the things that's behind the violence in the Middle East, specifically the relation between the Khazar Jews and the Arabs. And it's taken some of these events to, you know, rekindle my anti-Zionist credentials. There is no justification of this. I don't care what theory, other than straight-out Talmudic Jewish supremacism, you can muster. Last week, I did about a half hour on the settler movement, but I only scratched the surface. In fact, Israel is just one big settlement. And you may have come across mainstream publications condemning settler violence. But of course, settlement has been going on for a very long time at extreme levels of violence. And of course, Israel's still the only democracy in the area. So that's just for damage control. But what I'm going to do here is get into deeper detail, because this is a key issue. Current events don't mean anything unless we understand the ideas and the realities that hold them all together. Now, a settlement, in the sense that I'm using the term, in the Zionist sense of the term, refers to the forcible establishment of a Jewish community from Israel, Jews, to the occupied territories at the barrel of a gun. Settlers are and always will be the most fanatical and violent of all Zionists. Zionism is inherently fanatical and violent. And most settlements have been carved out using what you could call mafia-style private violence against local Arabs. They show up heavily armed and they start shooting, driving families from the land, knowing that no one in the world will condemn them. And given the nature of Israel, the ethnic foundation of it, the settlement that they create then creates the need to protect them from the anger of the obviously dispossessed Palestinians. The theft is then protected by the Israeli military, and the stolen lands are then expanded as Arabs are driven elsewhere, and the building of settlement buildings starts. The state subsidizes the building of a small town after the homes of the Arabs are demolished, and Arabs just suddenly find themselves homeless, and it really is quite that simple. Now, the Jews that occupy the land, especially in the smaller settlements, don't work. They live off subsidies from Jewish power centers the world over. The settlement practice, subsidized not just by the state of Israel, but American Jews and the U.S. government itself. In fact, in June, just a few months ago, Tel Aviv gave the green light to almost 5,000 more housing units for settlers in the West Bank, and that continues to grow. They've been growing for the last few years. There's all manner of fraudulent legal processes, but all settlements are based on violence. They're based on private Israeli citizens simply shooting their way to an area that they want. But of course, again, this is fully consistent, according to the State Department, with Israel's being the area's only democracy. It's also consistent, by the way, with the rule of law and private property rights, according to every single member of Congress, almost. And you'll hear occasional criticism of settlement policy from the U.S., as it, you know, justifies what they will call terrorism, but there's never been any sanctions or anything done on Tel Aviv. Now, it does make the job of the army a bit more difficult, because it becomes a very expensive and bloody thing to keep 100,000 angry Arabs away from 150 settlers, so that each settlement, the legal and so-called illegal ones, require direct military action, and it just stretches the Israeli military even thinner than it already is. It causes tremendous stress to Israel's conscript infantry, and settlers really do nothing but complain. And they complain especially that the army is not doing enough to protect them, so they form their own what amount to street gangs. Now, worse than all this is that international corporations have moved in. Settlements have become very wealthy in certain cases in the West Bank. And companies have financed their expansion. These are so-called settlement enterprises. And of course, it's based entirely on stolen Palestinian resources, land, water, minerals, water especially. And they produce all kinds of things that are sold for profit, often using very low-wage Arab labor. That, of course, is not protected by Israeli labor law. Millions every year worth of settlement goods are exported internationally. So many corporations are profiting from the theft of these lands, and they continue to be subsidized. Airbnb has listings in these settlements. Booking.com, which is a Jewish company, promotes tourism within these settlements. There's a whole industry here of theme parks, restaurants, and nightclubs on this land. Amnesty International had a whole paper on it in 2015. Believe it or not, they actually did something worthwhile. But it began in 1967. And since then, you've had tens of thousands of homes built, of course, for free, as far as the settlers go, built on Palestinian land to accommodate them. About 50,000 Palestinian homes and other structures, farms, storage structures, water tanks have been demolished. And that's, you know, and collective punishment is the Israeli norm. And more demolitions of Arab property and buildings are done for that reason. Entire families accused of attacks on Israelis, whether, you know, justified attacks or invented, depending on the circumstances. But this also includes the city of part of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, where 800 houses have been demolished since 2004. And I'm sure the number is far higher than that, because they didn't have a permit. Israel regularly confiscates Palestinian homes in the city and just hands them over to settlers. They either forcibly evict them or then they demolish their homes without providing any adequate alternative. So clearly Israel has created its own security problem. But I don't know how that's different from just Israel as a whole. Israel's just one big settlement. It functions along the same lines year to year to year. They're insured of a compliant press and a terrified American government. That gets their way all the time. They're simply used to it. Now, the 1967 war, the Six-Day War, that's what brought the Gaza Strip and the West Bank under Israeli control. And very quickly, about 200 settlements were established in the West Bank. You have, as of now, about 200 settlements officially recognized by the Ministry of the Interior, 110 that have been established with no authorization, but they still get state support, all throughout East Jerusalem. They've emptied entire neighborhoods of Arabs and Greek Orthodox, by the way, and brought Jews in. And now the disengagement plan that pulled the settlements out of Gaza, there were about 15 or 16 of them. That's been repealed. Last I heard, I think that was repealed yesterday or the day before. That would include the northern West Bank too. So wherever the settlers go in these occupied territories, they dominate the economic life of these areas. They're incredibly destructive. The total settler population is something like 620,000. So many of them are unreported, so it's probably higher. But 200,000 of these live within the jurisdiction of the city of Jerusalem. And about 415,000 live throughout the rest of the West Bank. And that comes from the Central Census Bureau as of December of 2017. And those have grown significantly since then. But it gets much worse than that. More land, these are always expanding, more land has been expropriated to pave hundreds of miles of roads for settler use only. And that's how they connect the settlements one to another and create a powerful economy. But that automatically implies roadblocks and checkpoints and every measure you could think of to limit Palestinian movement. So if the Palestinian economy there hadn't been broken already, since it's one big refugee camp, it's certainly broken now. It's Zionist arrogance at its height. The army is called in to fight problems that the settlers themselves have caused. Arabs are provoked beyond human reason, but they're murdered if they dare to fight back. Palestinian landowners have no property rights. They're denied access to farmlands, grazing, pastures, using whatever means possible. And so the very existence of a settlement means almost total dispossession in the name of Jewish supremacy. Most of you know the Talmudic warrant for all of this. Michael Hoffman has done far better than I could do in that regard. I recommend Michael Hoffman over most people. Most people will just kind of cut and paste the same lines over and over again. Michael Hoffman has a far more detailed understanding of those books. Jews have supported this massive separation barrier. This is militarized, it's very sophisticated, security wall established inside of the West Bank, and dividing the West Bank into areas A, B, and C. And that's a way to leave as many settlements as possible on the western side of the barrier, and taking all that land for themselves. Now, legally speaking, of course, it's really not that interesting because these are usually just violently carved out. But every once in a while, you'll have an American politician start questioning this. The French question this quite often, and I don't have to talk about the Turks. I talked about them on Thursday. Initially, when the Israeli state just stole land, they just said it was for national security, it's for military purposes. And, of course, these are such fanatical people and so heavily armed, they're willing to risk everything just to dispossess Arabs. As early, 79, the army issued a seizure order for land near Nablus, earmarked for the tiny settlement of Ilan Moreh. Of course, the Palestinians very naively went to the High Court of Justice, saying this is against international law, as if that matters. They said it served a civilian purpose, that is, settlement, rather than any kind of military need. And the court rejected the argument, of course, because the claim is that settlements contribute to security, because the protection of settlements is a military purpose, which, of course, is a circular argument. But there's limits. Even top security officials will state that a building, especially the Ilan Moreh case, building at that location will serve no military purpose. And what they mean is that it put a strain on the already strained security services in the West Bank. And the settlers, of course, joined this case, saying to the court that they wanted to settle permanently for ethnic reasons, religious reasons, rather than to promote security. So they create a security problem wherever they go, and any arguments against them from the IDF should be understood with that in mind. But the people at Ilan Mora, just to use one example, they couldn't claim that this was for a military purpose. The court, and we know this doesn't matter anymore because of Netanyahu's silencing of the court on many things, the court said no. Now, of course, they knew it was going to go anyway. But that was to say for that specific case. But this specific land theft was meant to serve a purely civilian, not a military purpose at all, and therefore breached international law. And you should roll your eyes when you hear that. It's certainly not a significant factor in Israeli courts, since they're usually not signatories to any of those things. But it is the position of the IDF at the time. But the court has made a few decisions in favor of the Palestinians. For example, on the cases concerning Gaza's right to its offshore gas deposits. And that's what began to irritate the Likud party, bringing about the judicial reforms I've dealt with earlier, and those reforms that have divided Israel so badly, at least rhetorically. But of course, there's no way the court can say that seizing privately owned land for building settlements is inherently a problem. It's just when the dominant reason for issuing a seizure order is the establishment of a civilian settlement rather than military necessity, the order should be discouraged. But settlers don't care. Settlers have attacked Israeli soldiers. If they get in the way, they'll attack anybody. Of course, it's never unlawful in their minds. The Talmud gives them full, the Amalek and the subhumanity of the Arabs and people like you and me. So the settlement's going to go ahead regardless, but at least that's something that they have on paper. Now, as far as the military was concerned, remember, these are conscript kids who not only have to protect a handful of Jews from thousands of Arabs, but are constantly being attacked by the settlers themselves. I mean, quite literally in some cases, because I haven't shot enough Palestinians. I was on, just before I started here today, on one of the Hebrew language forums that they have connected to these settlements. Google Translate actually isn't half bad in Hebrew, I guess. I don't read it, so. But, you know, this is how they talk. This is normal for them. They're hysterical. They're fanatical, they're bloodthirsty, and if they don't have anyone to kill, they'll kill each other. But they have no problem attacking Israeli soldiers. So there was an informal custom that came about that the security people in a specific area had to reach a consensus concerning any advantage for the settlement. But it's also been made clear that settlers need to keep their intentions to themselves. Secrecy, as we'll hear about in a minute, is extremely important. I'm saying here that the settlement idea is the core of Zionism. The Israeli government just will declare it state land if they absolutely have to. The West Bank was carved out of former Jordanian land. Gaza was taken from Egypt. But there was considered, some years ago, the desire to create a row of settlements around the central mountain ridge of the West Bank, so to have the high ground. So Israel then revoked the old Ottoman land code, which was a much older set of laws that governed land ownership in the West Bank for many years. And it was just to give a legal cover for the declaration of theft. So when the land in question was under private or collective Arab ownership, no matter what law it is, Ottoman, British, Jordanian, they simply have repealed those laws. One of the things that they do is that they claim that if Palestinians aren't regularly cultivating the farmland, in other words, you know, working on it every year, then it's forfeit. And since the Israelis have made that impossible in most places, it's just a fraudulent way of stealing land. They used to have, according to the old legal codes, there were, you know, a local custom where collective, you know, Palestinian communities could, you know, use grazing lands and public lands as a collective, albeit de facto owner. And those have been confiscated. And if worse comes to worst, you know, the settlers can simply shoot a few people. And then because they're Jews, well, Israel has no choice but to go in and, once the violence dies down, fully support it retroactively. So from 79 to 2002, you had about 300,000 acres of Palestinian land stolen. As many of you know, the West Bank is divided into areas A, B, and C. We'll get to the significance of that in a little bit. I mean, the West Bank isn't ginormous to begin with. Now there's about 300,000 acres of state land just in Area C, about 40% of the entire area, and about a quarter of the whole West Bank. Sectors A and B are under the Palestinian Authority. And there's more detail there I'll talk about in 1 second. So Palestinians maybe have access to between 40 and 50% of the West Bank. Now, there are Jewish liberal groups, B'Tselem, Peace Now, and some of these. Yeah, they're more or less Zionists, but they think it's very bad press to have this stuff going on. I mean, these are just vigilante cults, deeply Talmudic. In fact, that's all they do all day is study Talmud. Claiming that, well, Jordan has repudiated control over that land because they lost the war. Therefore, no one owns it. You know, it's just one scheme after another. Private Palestinian land is taken, and no one tells these people. So you wake up one morning, there's 100 settlers at your door, a couple lawyers, and that's it. You have to leave. And if you dare say anything, you know, being beaten up is probably your best conclusion there. But at no point does international law ever make any difference. Law is only as powerful as a regime enforcing it. That goes for international law, and that goes for the Palestinians in these territories. I don't need documents, you know, I don't need detailed arguments as to why this is an evil policy. But American corporations are invested there. American corporations are profiting there. Amnesty International will write a nasty letter, and they'll say, oh, yes, we're not going to do that anymore, and of course nothing ever changes. And needless to say, the burden of proof always lay with the Arabs claiming ownership. But it doesn't matter even if that proof could be given. They have 1,000 different ways of justifying it. Of course, the American press buys every syllable of it, not really knowing any better. But whether it be authorized by the state or just retroactively authorized by the state, this is a violent, a private violent, vigilante mafia-style approach. But even if they actually had a real legal claim, the treaty ending that war said that this has to serve the population of the occupied territory, not the state of Israel. But without really much of a justification, Tel Aviv just forbids Palestinians to use their lands almost entirely, and then claiming that it's been abandoned or handed over because no one's working it. And this keeps expanding and expanding and expanding. Closed military zones, they claim, and of course Palestinians can't enter it. Most of Area C, I believe, Palestinians cannot enter. But Israeli citizens, ethnic Jews from around the world, can enter all of these areas freely. The settlers have their regional councils. They're recognized by the state, but really de facto. Those councils themselves control another 450,000 acres, including huge open areas that haven't been attached to anyone in particular, but stolen through all of these different methods. Area C now is about 63% under either settler or state control. And that doesn't include other lands. There's something like 40 military installations just in the West Bank. Settlers have built their own checkpoints, their own roads. This is the one and only place that they're willing to sow the fields. graze livestock. And of course, water is scarce and precious, and that's one of the first things that they do. Of course, the Palestinians could be enraged at this, but all that ends up doing is lead to extremely violent reprisals, either from the settlers or the IDF or both. So the settlers have long created various independent militias for this kind of thing, and then it forces Israel to expand settlement blocks to protect them. In public, of course, they'll decry this stuff. They don't do that anymore, but they did for a long time. So you have just mountains of land in that part of the world, Palestinian homes demolished, American corporations coming in, planning the shopping malls and everything else they do. All kinds of, every kind of construction you could think of, legal or illegal. The state will condemn it on one side of their mouth, and on the other hand, they'll subsidize it and send the IDF in to protect it if worse comes to worse. And if all that fails, the Palestinian communities will just be thrown to the courts, red tape, bureaucracy, legal hurdles, and by the time anything gets done, the settlers have already burnt them out. Now, let me quote something from the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., and this goes a bit to explain the areas A, B, and C of the West Bank. They say this, and this is back in 2015, the vast majority of Israeli settler attacks occur in areas B and C where Israel alone is responsible for security. Palestinian security forces are not permitted to operate in these areas. Two types of Israeli forces operate in areas B and C, the Israeli police and the military. While Palestinian police have limited jurisdiction in Area B and zero in Area C, they can only exercise it in instances where the perpetrators are not Israeli citizens and where crimes are not related to Israel's security interests. The article on criminal jurisdiction in the legal protocol in the Oslo Accords states that Israel has sole criminal jurisdiction over offenses committed in the territory by Israelis, and that Palestinian authorities shall not arrest Israelis or place them in custody. This means that settlers choosing to commit attacks in areas B and C, where the vast majority of attacks take place, know that if they face any prosecution, it will be in the Israeli criminal justice system. The same author notes that the chance of a complaint submitted to the Israel police by a Palestinian will lead absolutely nowhere. Any kind of prosecution, and this is actually from a Jewish group, I think it's Peace Now, that said the conviction rate is about 1%, which is another way of saying impossible. Now, the Oslo Accords saying what they say is purely Talmudic. The Talmud strictly forbids a non-Jew to have any jurisdiction over a Jew. To think that Israel will permit a non-Jew to arrest a Jew is an outrage. The Oslo Accords were written with that in mind. So the arrangement was designed to facilitate settler violence, making any appeals to courts or the U.S. extremely naive, and it makes a mockery of the official Israeli condemnations of settler violence, which you hear from time to time. Again, 1967, Israel emerged victorious in the Six-Day War, the Third Arab-Israeli War, and annexed big parts of the surrounding territory from neighboring Arab states, Egypt and Jordan, as I say, and they became the occupied territory. The dislocation of the populations there from then to now have been immensely significant. Just at the time, just in 67, 500,000 Palestinians fled or were expelled from the West Bank, and 110,000 Syrians from the Golan Heights were removed. The main reason Arabs hate Israel, the main reason, despite all the arguments about the Khazars and everything else, that they shouldn't be there, is the nature of the settlements. You can't have anything, even the very weak conception of a Palestinian state that you heard under the Trump administration, some of their, we covered it on Daily Nationalist, silly proposals for a state that's not really a state. It can't happen when you have settlements. That's the point of the settlements. There's no two-state solution when these settlements exist everywhere. I was just looking at the map, also on Peace Now's website, comparing Palestinian and Jewish settlements in the West Bank, And I think the numbers and the percentages, just by, I mean, I went on, they have street view. I'm walking around some of these settlements. Some of them are absolutely gorgeous. And then you go to the Palestinian area where they usually don't have the Google Street View, which shouldn't be a big shock. There's far more of these Jewish settlements than the official numbers suggest. Early on, from 67 to the mid-70s, the Israelis said, well, we have no control over this. This is the work of individual settlers being financed by the World Zionist Organization or whatever. And they say that the state neither approved nor could prevent their expansion. Now, there's been some new documents released. I mentioned these before. I don't need these documents to tell me this is all nonsense. But it was very clear in January of 1971, Golda Meir's cabinet meetings stressed secrecy. And let me quote just one area in talking about the settlements. She said to her minister, she said, before we move forward with our discussion, there's something I'd like to ask. It was our habit that for anything that has to do with settlements, outposts, land expropriation, and so on, we simply do not talk about it. Lately, this has broken down, and I'm asking ministers for the sake of our homeland to hold back, talk less, and do as much as possible. But the main thing, as much as possible, is to talk less. I'm working, finishing my paper on this topic, and I titled it, the main title is, We Simply Do Not Talk About It. And for very good reason. This isn't, you know, this isn't an aberration. This is the core of practical Zionism. And much of it is meant to be, by her own words, kept secret from the world in political, legal, and even theological terms. She said to her ministers, do not attend opening ceremonies of these settlements. Do not allow yourself to be seen by the media anywhere in these areas, despite the fact that Zionism was entrenched in the Western press by this time. And throughout the 70s, this was, you know, this secrecy remained in force. The very first settlement, at least the first authorized settlement, was in Gittit in the West Bank. And I'll tell the story of Gittit because this laid the template for how settlements were to go from here on in. The closest Arab village was Akraba. Of course, the first attempt was just brute force. Soldiers show up out of nowhere and demand of the Arabs that they vacate the area. The claim was they were going to build a military training zone, which itself was a lie. Well, the Palestinians just ignored them. They continued to cultivate the land. The soldiers get irritated, and then they start smashing the Arabs' farming tools. When they still refuse to move, the IDF was ordered from Tel Aviv to use their armored vehicles to destroy crops, to physically make it impossible for Arabs to work. Then they called for a small crop duster plane to spray toxic chemicals on the village, killed all the animals, and was very dangerous to humans. Chemical warfare, by the way, is nothing new. They still refused to move, largely because they didn't have anywhere to go. They increased the use of gas. In April 1972, the IDF Central Command met with representatives of the Jewish Agency's Settlements Department. They established the, quote, responsibility and schedule for the spraying at such concentrated doses that it would keep any human being away for days. In fact, the Jewish Agency rented the plane. They destroyed the harvest. They burnt everything that they could. And yet, the Arabs held firm. Very naively, the mayor of Akraba wrote Moshe Dayan. He said, the village has 400 residents. We had 36,000 acres of land. All their wheat has been burned. They gassed the residents. They poisoned the soil, at least for a couple seasons, took whatever land they possibly could, and all of these Arabs were left with about 6,000 acres. Not sure what he thought he was going to do with Moshe Dayan, of all people, who was defense minister. But by May of 1973, they finally succeeded. The settlers, of course, were involved legally, too. This was kind of a new process. And they were granted permission by the state to, quote, seize the land for the purpose of establishing a settlement. 3 months later, the construction began. At the time, any mention of these practices were met with hysterical cries of anti-Semitism or blood libel and all this. In 1974, the Israel Lands Administration put more settlements into the process. Male Admunim, sorry, was the name of the settlement, and it was established long before the state ever said anything. A former IDF general, who became a member of the Knesset, was a part of this settlement, and he lobbied the Jewish Agency, which is a private organization, to allocate an appropriate budget for the effort. But the housing minister at the time, at a meeting of the cabinet, his name was Yeshua Rabinovitz, didn't understand. He was kind of naive, and he said, well, this settlement has no budget. I don't know how work is being started without first sitting down with us. And at the time, it was Yitzhak Rabin who was the prime minister, and he said, well, that's what we're meeting about right now. There might be room for clarifying the issue, but I wouldn't suggest going into it today. I know it might not be following the neatest definitions, but I'm in favor of them starting to carry out the infrastructure work. You know, he got the message. It's just another way of saying all parties and interest groups of any significance among the Israelis agreed with this policy, and they just kept it to themselves. Yes, there was no meeting, there was no budget, but that doesn't mean money didn't change hands. But it doesn't end there. Going way back, the Israelis have used some of the nastiest weapons. I mean, we all know that they spray raw sewage into homes that refuse to move, that they've been doing that in East Jerusalem. You know, Orthodox churches, Orthodox, there's no monasteries there anymore, but in private homes of Arabs and Greeks. But, you know, they were used, this kind of thing was done at the very foundation of the Zionist state. That the Israelis used chemical weapons in the 1948 War of Independence is now beyond debate. Alon Ben Meir uncovered the documents there, uncovered in September of 2022, that in the 1948 Nakba, the disaster, the mass population transfer, private Zionist militias used chemical and biological weapons in order to more effectively expel the Arabs from their lands. And by their own words, poison gas was used to slow the advance of intervening Arab armies and poison citizens of neighboring states. That's a direct quote. Long before 1967, about 80% of mandatory Palestine was declared Israel. The very first act of Israel was to expel 700,000 Palestinians, the deliberate destruction of over 500 villages by Zionist militias, and of course, endless massacres. So it's the same methods. Israel is just one big settlement. At the time, as I've spoken of at great length, they were backed not by the U.S., but by Soviet weapons and diplomacy in the early years. The U.S., at least some of them, were worried about their holdings in oil-rich Arab monarchies at the time. But the Soviets were far more enthusiastic than the Americans were. So with Stalin's support, the Zionists felt free to do whatever the heck they wanted, creating millions of permanent refugees in their own country. It shattered Palestinian society in every respect. So biological weapons, poison gas, this is the very foundation of Israel. Today, of course, they use white phosphorus gas on Gazans, and is fully accepted in Tel Aviv and Washington. Back in 1948, they were using biological agents, typhoid, dysentery, and malaria, by contaminating the local water supply and just releasing toxins in the air, typical artillery shells, whatever they needed. And it was covered up for decades. Again, any accusation about it would be met with screams and hysteria about blood libel and everything else. Zionist militias in 1948 won because they used poison gas and biological agents. Zionist militia poisoned the aqueduct at Kopti, central source of water for Palestinian settlements, right in the heart of what's today Israel. And the papers that have been discovered at New York University, actually it's the Jewish Settlements Archival Project of New York University, they've finally been unearthed, and they say that this is the most serious and potent use of biological weapons since World War I. And it was actually being used before the conflict formally began. You had a huge city of Accra, The UN thought this was going to be, you know, the core of the future Arab state, depended heavily on this very aqueduct. Of course, they had the money to purify this, and the poisoning wasn't permanent, but it's why they won the war. Now, even the Israeli writers, even those like Clarenberg, well, not even Clarenberg, the writers who helped uncover all of this, tried to minimize it. They claimed that this was a failed strategy that the Israelis abandoned. Now, of course, we all know what the term Rodef means. Rodef is literally a pursuer, and it's a Jew who exposes the crimes of another Jew to the Goyim. Now, this, you know, was a failed strategy nonsense. The very same documents from the IDF archives, you know, prove that it's an absolute lie. And they've been using these tactics for decades. And in the paper that's based on these revelations, I'm going to quote Clarenberg here, just from this year. Zionist militants had for some time been targeting Arab soldiers directly with biological weapons. In late May that year, 1948, Egypt's foreign minister sent a cable to the UN Secretary General announcing the recent arrest of two Zionist agents who admitted that they had been instructed to contaminate the springs from which the Egyptian troops at Gaza drew their water supply. The pair acknowledged having dropped typhoid and dysentery germs into nearby wells and were found to be in possession of several bottles containing a liquid which was discovered to contain the germs of dysentery and typhoid. Now, of course, today, we all know that Israel has nuclear and biological and chemical weapons, mostly hidden by the press. And there's a reason why Israel refuses to sign the 1975 Biological Weapons Convention and the UN's 1997 Chemical Weapons Convention. See, the concentration camps in Germany had full-time Red Cross offices inspecting everything that was going on. Israel refuses to allow anyone to inspect their weapons, suggesting that they're at a ready state. Same thing for their nuclear arsenal, and we all know what the Samson option is. The doctrine that in the face of massive military defeat against the Arabs, Israel will nuke itself before it surrenders. And that includes the use of chemical agents too. But all of these documents, all these conversations that have only recently been unearthed, hidden for five decades, were released, no doubt confident the media would downplay what they contained, and of course they were right about that. And there's many more documents that maybe will never see the light of day. But the core point here is that this is at the basis of how Zionism operates. And no other movement could ever function this way. It's just simply a testament to Jewish power. I just downloaded the list of, this is from Wikipedia, by the way, of the Jews in major positions in finance. It's 19 single space pages. And that wasn't even the whole thing. And we know today that nothing has changed. Israel's invasion of the West Bank over the summer, the Jenin refugee camp, I've spoken about that before, as well as the use of poison gas on the Gaza Strip today, nothing has changed. I said last week, Israel had been targeting hospitals since 1948. Witnesses to a man have said, and this is in the West Bank, that Israeli forces were destroying infrastructure and public property. Snipers were stationed inside armored vehicles on rooftops, firing live rounds at unarmed Palestinians. Lynn Hastings, who's the UN humanitarian coordinator in Palestine, confirmed all of this. And this is last year. Since 2022, they've been raiding the West Bank, a large invasion over the summer. This is why Hamas did what they did. The Palestinian resistance in the West Bank was far stiffer than they had expected. They lost a lot of, I said this on Thursday, Israel has lost a huge amount of armored vehicles and men. But in July of this year, it was a few months ago, Bezalel was given sweeping authority over the West Bank, overseeing settlement development, And Israel, of course, maintains full security. And he's the head of a major religious Zionist. Actually, it's the Religious Zionist Party. He also has people in the Ministry of Security. And these people select the leadership of the civil administration in the occupied territory. The Religious Zionism Party is the party of the settler movement, now wields power beyond its size over the lives of those in the West Bank. Now a member of Ben-Gvir's Jewish Power Party has Yitzhak Wasserlov been put in position where he oversees the Negev and Galilee regions occupied by Israel since its founding. And he has authorized recognizing 70 illegal outposts in the West Bank. And of course, they now have control, this party now has control over Negev and Galilee. These policies are getting bloodier and bloodier and bloodier. Smotrich himself said there's going to be, make way for an additional 500,000 settlers in the West Bank to quickly build up the infrastructure and the services. And they're able to do this because Netanyahu is totally dependent on these little parties for his majority in the Knesset. The disengagement plan of 2005 has been completely repealed now. It's one of the reasons. And you know, Hamas was well aware of all of this. Now, in times of war for Israel, when public attention is focused elsewhere, this is a key point where settlers take action. So for the Second Intifada, 2002-2003, the settlers established 43 new outposts. In the first week, so in the week following October 7th, the day of the Hamas operation in Gaza, you see a huge spike in settler violence. They're claiming that these are revenge actions for Hamas, even though it's in a different part of the country. And the same Ben-Gvir, Itamar Ben-Gvir, announced that he's giving out 10,000 weapons to civilian emergency response teams, which is just another word for settler militias. But before the invasion, the regime was reporting that the violence from Israeli settlers caused the displacement of over 1,000 Palestinians just then, long before the Hamas operation. The displacement of Palestinians is a daily event, and it's increased. The UN says that there's 3 settler-related acts of violence each day in the West Bank, the highest average since 2006 when they started worrying about these things. Just since September, they've emptied 5 Palestinian communities entirely. Huge exodus, although I'm not sure where they're going. Israeli police, since the Hamas action, have said that they're going to ease the process of obtaining weapons licenses. The regional council in the Benjamin area, this is a council comprising about 50 settlements in the West Bank, declared that the rules of engagement in the West Bank have changed. And this is a direct quote from them: one should shoot at anyone approaching a settlement to cause harm. And I'm sure the phrase "to cause harm" is interpreted in the most liberal possible way. And Tel Aviv is fully in favor of it. On October 12th, the head of the Samaria Regional Council, again, the settlement group, said that the council had purchased hundreds of weapons using donations collected abroad, probably mostly from the U.S. The week following the Hamas attack, there's been a huge attempt, especially on social media, to recruit security for these fairly small and illegal outposts. Calls for volunteers to come and, quote, enhance the security of these outposts. Some of these are just inhabited by a family or two and a few volunteers, despite the fact they are protected by the IDF, but the IDF is very, to say the least, overstretched. The number of attacks against Palestinians since the Hamas action have gone through the roof, all over the place. There's been dozens and dozens of Palestinians killed directly. The IDF and the settlers kind of mingle together when these things happen, so no one really knows, is it a military action or is it a private action? Even the funeral processions of those that they've killed have been fired on by the settlers. wherever they go, there's like, you know, in any given, all these pictures and videos on YouTube that I've seen, there's like 20 settlers. They're usually filthy, with automatic American-made weapons, and a handful of guys in uniform. Now, there are some settlers who do wear uniforms for the sake of confusion, but they've even taken hostages, and they shoot, so no one's quite sure who's killing them. Every day there's something new. On the 13th of October, settlers entered into the village of Al-Tuwani in the southern Hebron Hills, and one of the settlers, young man, new recruit to the army, shot a Palestinian in the abdomen, unprovoked, even according to Jewish writer. Dozens of incidents just over the last few weeks documented where settlers entered into small Palestinian communities, threatened residents, stole property, harmed livestock, set fire to vehicles, set fire to homes, and demand that the residents evacuate. Any response from the Arabs is called terrorism. Back in January last year, 2022, the Minister of Internal Security at the time, Omar Barlev, admitted that the settlers practiced, quote, organized terror against Palestinians in the West Bank. The number of attacks by settlers against Palestinians carried out in front of Israeli soldiers has doubled since then. Physical assaults, vandalism, the burning of property, the burning of crops, this is normal Jewish behavior. But because you now have heightened observation, it's starting to be noticed. Firebomb attacks, some of these militias. I have a bunch of pictures of these guys. Some of them wearing uniforms, meaning that they could have been, you know, reservists or something like that, are personally demolishing homes. And settlers will attack any, and this is from the IDF itself, settlers will attack IDF soldiers if they try to stop any of these shootings or firebombings. And they've done that many times in the past. So since the Hamas attack, settlers just there, and again, there's no real, you know, war with Hamas in the West Bank. This is a Gaza matter. The settlers have killed more than 120 Palestinians just since October 7th and injured at least 2,000. And you know the numbers are much higher than that. Just since the Hamas attack, settlers have expelled more than 800 Palestinians from their homes. They've blown up the generators. They've destroyed all the solar panels. But then, on October 25th, you have those controlling this Joe Biden zombie gave this ritual condemnation, and Biden kind of semi-coherently mumbled, saying that these attacks in the West Bank are pouring gasoline on the tensions unleashed by the war. It has to stop, and those involved have to be held accountable. Of course, he had no idea what he was saying, but American politicians say this all the time. This is, you know, that ridiculous pseudo-intellectual publication Slate, which is heavily Jewish. And this is about how they do damage control. Let me quote just one paragraph from a stupid article that they wrote. Israeli officials must do all this in part for Israel's own sake. Vigilante groups cannot be allowed to go on rampages in a democratic country, but even more, to associate the Israeli government from these killings, to make clear that it does not equate Palestinians with Hamas and that it is committed to protecting innocent Palestinians in the West Bank. And of course, they're talking about the settlers. But since this is basically a Jewish publication, the author is aware of how absurd his statements are. Vigilante groups have for many decades gone on rampages through the occupied territories without the slightest concern from the editors of Slate magazine. But it doesn't matter. They still call Israel democratic. The Israeli government always maintains plausible deniability concerning the settlers. And finally, as far as the mainstream of Israeli life is concerned, all Arabs in the territories are Amalek, and hence they are slated for death, at least formally. There's never been a real distinction between Palestinian and terrorist, so long as Israel has been in existence. And that's kind of the whole point of settlement in the first place. The liberal Jewish condemnation of settler violence, you only hear this when the goyim get a whiff of how the Jews are actually behaving. It's like the mechanical words of that Joe Biden zombie I quoted above. It's an attempt to appear even-handed, but it's only rhetoric. Hundreds of similar papers and articles condemn Hamas in the most vehement terms and are fanatically Zionist. But of course, we'll have one or two lines condemning the settlers. And they're well aware of the contradiction, since Israel is just one big settlement. It's just doing damage control. The stories of this violence are leaking into the mainstream from the left, from Amnesty International to SLEM and all these other groups. And there are some Jewish groups who simply can't handle this. Some of them are certainly sincere. But, you know, I don't need international law to tell me that this is an evil and, to say the least, counterproductive policy. Now, technically, international law states that an occupying power may not relocate its own citizens to an occupied territory or even make permanent changes to that territory. Unless, of course, there is an imperative military need or it's done for the benefit of the local population. Now, international law is not the grounds for any argument. It has almost zero relevance, not to mention being laughably vague. It's only for rhetoric. Yet, where did international law come from? Ultimately, it comes from Jewish claims of a Holocaust. And it proves that the Jewish attachment to these principles is nothing but ethnic self-interest. They're not principles at all. International law as it stands now, regardless of its irrelevance, came from the Allied interpretation of the Second World War. But that very same war saw not just the empowerment of Stalin, but the deliberate incineration of entire German and Japanese cities. So this contradiction in ethnic self-interest is built into the very concept of international law. Clearly, these principles apply only to certain people. And I recommend the Ericott book from 2019, goes into this at great length, the Jewish author. The whole point of settlement and the construction projects that come from it is meant to preclude any possibility of any kind of independent, viable Palestinian state. Now, the West Bank technically is not part of Israel's sovereign territory. It really doesn't matter, since Israel applies its normal domestic laws to settlers, but of course never to Arabs. So settlers are protected by the same privileges as citizens in Israel proper. Of course, Palestinians are permanently in refugee camps under martial law. They're seen as goyim or cattle. And really, the occupied territories, this is kind of a test run for a much larger global order based on their doctrine of the Messiah or Antichrist. So Israel gets away with establishing laws based entirely on ethnicity, something Jews will condemn if established anywhere else. The genocide, and you know I don't use that word very often, that's the point of settlement. The removal of Arabs, the depopulation of places like Gaza, not just from the Six-Day War on, but from its very founding. All Israeli legal funding, defense bodies, and institutions work to finance, defend, and justify these guys. And that really is part of the Israeli constitution that remains quite conveniently unwritten. And this is just the beginning. This is what Arabs come across every day. Now, what does this do to the Arab psyche? What does it do to kids growing up? What kind of trauma reaction are they going to have? What is the mental illness in these areas like for Arabs and kids growing up there? Of course, no one's going to ask that. No one even would know how to ask something like that. They don't think in those terms. Arabs are terrorists. That's how the dumb American Republican thinks. Well, American, you know, opinion is always up and down on that kind of thing. But Protestantism these days is not really a theology. It's a foreign policy theory. The neoconservatism that somehow Jewish supremacy is the same as American exceptionalism. I do want to say, in fact, Grandpa Dan mentioned this to me today, that given other countries now involved in the war against Israel and the huge depopulation of Ukraine, it's possible that we're seeing a metamorphosis of the new Khazaria idea. Now, with a Russian victory in at least half of the country, it's going to be difficult. You know, if they could settle in the desert and create these corporations, then certainly they could colonize southern Ukraine and do the same, no matter what condition it's in. They have no shortage of money. The Russian invasion, of course, Russians have fully supported Hamas. They recognized the election in 2006, and the resistance leaders have already been to Moscow. Moscow is trading heavily in every imaginable way with Iran. And of course, Iraq is, you know, in the process of kicking out whoever's left. The point of course, all of these American attacks is to render the Arab world impoverished. There was no nuclear weapons program. What Israel worried about was nuclear power. This diversification. Saddam Hussein was financing this. The Gulf monarchies are financing this. This was the threat. As I said before, you have two Islamic powers, Turkey and Iran, first world governments, first world economies, first world militaries. It is conceivable that the plan B would not be the Samson option, but the colonization of a now depopulated Ukraine to create a new Khazaria. But there's a lot of ifs there, but it is worth thinking about, and it is an interesting idea. New Khazaria is one of the deepest secrets of the Zionist movement. If Israel is simply too small and too exposed and too violent to render it viable over time, especially now, the warfare is going to be even more continuous. The settlers are driving the army crazy with their endless provocations. The Khazar Empire, the dominance of the Jewish oligarchs in Ukraine, make it a possibility. You know, their big slave mart was on the island of Kafa in the Caspian Sea. This has a sacred presence to what it, at least they'll be in a Khazar territory, but of course they would have no right to be there either, given they haven't existed there in a very long time. But Putin's invasion has changed that, at least for the moment. Nothing has remained the same. Everything has changed, and we've got to remember how quickly things change, not just in international politics, but in domestic politics as well. Anything can happen. Pray to God, pray to St. Paisius, pray to St. John of Kronstadt that we get some relief at some point. But at least we know we're doing the right thing as best we can. Thank you again, everyone, for listening and donating. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.